Apparently, Van Gogh, when he died at the end of his life, his great career, had sold precisely one painting. One painting in all those years. He painted hundreds and hundreds, and just one was sold. He got a few into galleries, but never made any money from it. He had a few exhibited, mostly by friends, but again, got no fame, no glory. And a question to start with is, back when he was alive, was Van Gogh a great painter? Okay, was he a great painter when he was alive? Was he a great painter? I guess the answer has got to be yes, hasn't it? Now it's recognised, so I wrote this down. Apparently, the last one of his paintings that was sold by Christie's went for $145 million. $145 million. Today he's recognised widely, you know, one of the greatest artists ever, and is seen to be great. But when he was alive, was he great? Well, of course he was. He was great because he's a good painter. He's great because he can mix his colours well, he can capture light well, he can transform what he sees through his mind onto the canvas. He was great because he was talented. His output was good. His product was good. The reason I start with that little illustration is that the story Jesus tells today, or the passage we're looking at, is about greatness. And as we begin, I think for Christians, our first instinct is that any idea that we want to be great is wrong and sinful. Any idea that we aspire to be great people is somehow pompous. But actually, Jesus never really talks like that. If you look down to verse 43, and we're breaking right in towards the end of the conversation. But it shall not be among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first must be slave of all. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Jesus doesn't say, stop having ambitions for being great. Don't look for greatness. He says, if you want to be great, this is how to do it. And just so we're on the right track as we start, I think what Jesus wants is Van Gogh-like Christians. Not Christians who want to be seen as great and recognised and sort of pointed out as the streets. Oh, that's that guy at Christchurch Derby. Or, do you know so-and-so? He's so humble. Okay, he's such a servant. He'll put himself up for anybody. He doesn't want people who are seen as great. That's what we think of as greatness, isn't it? Being recognised and praised. He wants people who actually are great. And in Jesus' definition of great, actually being great means people who will serve anybody. So the desire to be great is right. It's just got to be carried out in the right way. Van Gogh-like Christians, not about being recognised, but about our products, if you like, to be crude about it, what we produce, i.e. our lifestyle, being great, being what Jesus wants. So Van Gogh Christians, that's what we want. And if anyone can raise $145 million, that would help for the next couple of years. The scene, though, is set in verse 32. They're walking on the road to Jerusalem, and Jesus has been pretty clear that they're going to die. And so what he does, again, he takes them aside and for the third time explains that when they get to Jerusalem, he'll be killed. So verse 33, see, he says to the disciples, we're going to Jerusalem and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes and they'll condemn him to death, deliver him to the Gentiles, mock him, spit on him, flog him, kill him. And after 3 days, he'll rise. It's the third time he's predicted his death and his resurrection. And each time he fills in a little bit more detail. This time the Gentiles are there. The fact that he'll be humiliated, spat at, flogged, is there. The idea of Jesus being shamed is going to be important for this passage. But just by where it started, I just want to remind us that actually for Jesus, all his lessons about discipleship, about what it means to follow him, about what it means to be a Christian, are preceded in Mark's Gospel by a little talk on the cross. There's a sort of catchphrase that's going around nowadays in the sort of church leadership circles, at least, about having a cross-centred ministry or a gospel-centred ministry. And actually, it's a tremendously helpful one. Jesus doesn't just sit down one day and just give a massive load of ways to obey him and follow him. So he doesn't just sit and give a talk on being a servant, followed by a talk on how you've got to suffer for the gospel, followed by a talk on how you've got to share your faith. No, instead, he gives a little talk on the cross and then uses that as a way into, well, various different aspects of discipleship. It's a cross that motivates following, the cross that powers discipleship. And actually, if we haven't understood the cross, that Jesus has come and died for us, we won't have the power to follow. And so conversely, if you find yourself powerless, and you hear some of these talks on a Sunday, or you read the Bible yourself and think, well, actually, I'd love to, but I just can't. The way to find the power is not to concentrate on the following, but on the person you're following, on Christ. And it says you look to him and understand the cross more, that he gives us the power to follow in his footsteps. If we also focus on what we should do, we'll end up beating ourselves up and powerless. Or if we have a half-decent crack at it, we'll just end up proud. If we end up focused on Christ and his cross, that fuels the following. So for the third time, he predicts his death. And this time, what's the lesson going to be? Look on to verse 35. James and John, two of the three of his closest friends, James, John and Peter, the ones he spends most time with. James and John here, I'm going to be killed, I'm going to be spat at, I'm going to be mocked. What do they say? Great. Well, anyway, please can we have the best seats in the kingdom when it comes about? Okay, they're so crass. Verse 33, teacher, we want to do for you whatever we ask of you. It's such a child's question, isn't it? Daddy, will you give me something if I ask you nicely? Well, depends what it is. Jesus isn't sucked in. What do you want me to do for you, he says. And they say, grant us to sit one at your right hand, at one at your left, in your glory. They've got the idea, it's hard to know what they've understood, but they've got the idea somewhat that Jesus is going to be enthroned. Now, they've got completely the wrong idea about how it's going to happen, but they get that he's going to have glory. And so they say, look, we realise you're the king, we're not the boss, we're not God, you are. But if you're king, can I sit at your left and can my brother sit at your right? Okay, we'll be Robin to your Batman, basically. You're the best one, we recognise that, but can we be kind of second and third? Massively insensitive, given he's just said he's going to be crucified. What they want, to go back to our sort of Van Gogh illustration, is they want the fame, the glory, and the power. They're not interested in being good followers of Christ, they're interested in being seen to be great. In being seen to be great. The irony, of course, is that when Jesus is at his most glorious, he's crucified. And the people at his left hand and his right hand are two criminals. Both of whom are being executed. James and John have got no idea what they're asking for. And in fact, that's exactly what he says to them, verse 38. You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I'm baptized? Now, those are both references to the Old Testament. I've asked Lauren to put some on a PowerPoint to save us flicking them up. So from Isaiah 51. Wake yourself, stand up, O Jerusalem. You have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath. You have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering. This cup comes several times in the Old Testament. There it is, the cup of wrath, God's wrath, or the cup of staggering. Can I have the next one? Thus the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup of the wine of wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. Jeremiah this time. The cup, again, is of God's wrath. Again, I think there's just one more. And this one's particularly helpful, I think. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The cup is not a good thing. You don't want the cup. It's something that God gives you, but actually, it's something that God gives you to punish you. And here in particular, it's about being shamed instead of being glorified, which is going to be particularly appropriate for the passage in question. So the cup is that. The cup that Jesus is going to drink is the cup of God's wrath. As for the baptism, well, again, we've got a verse or two here. Baptism is a sign in the Bible, not primarily actually of me having become a Christian, but of God's judgment falling. Okay, being covered in water is a picture of God's judgment falling. So you think of the flood when the people are washed away. Or we think of the Exodus, where they walk through the Red Sea. And this is what the passage that Paul's commentating on here. I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and when he hits the Red Sea and it opens up, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. The crossing of the Red Sea was like a baptism. There's all sorts of other... I'm not sure I put any more on, actually, did I? Okay, great, that's it. All sorts of other verses in the New Testament that talk about baptism being a sign of judgment. Okay, so when you're baptized, what you're saying is, I deserve to die. Thankfully, because I'm united to Christ, the baptism falls on him. So your baptism, if you like, is uniting you, symbolically, to Jesus' baptism. Both pictures essentially are saying, I am going to suffer God's wrath. That's what I'm going to do. And so when he says to them, can you share them? They say, verse 39, yeah. They're clueless. They've got no idea. Absolutely no idea. The heart of the cross is that Jesus undergoes what we don't have to. And here particularly, I think, he's talking about shame. I think one of the dangers with talking about the cross is that we talk about it so often that it almost becomes a little anemic. It sort of doesn't really affect us anymore. And that's because sometimes I think we don't look at it from enough different perspectives. Here it's shame in particular that's being emphasised. There's something wrong. If you ever see pictures of Jesus crucified, there's usually one thing that's wrong on pretty much every single one. Do you know what it is? Anytime you see a picture of Jesus crucified, more or less. Always clothed. Okay, he's always clothed. He's always got at least a loincloth on or something. He was crucified naked. And he was crucified naked because he was being shamed. It's a picture, if you like, of him being opened up, having no protection, no covering. And the picture is one of exposure of sin. On the cross, Paul says, he became sin who had no sin. So Jesus has all our sin put on him and is exposed. He's naked. Embarrassing as you could get. But our sin is put on him and he's exposed, so we never have to be shamed. We never have to be exposed. That means that all the things that you're so embarrassed about, you just pray no one ever finds out about. Even perhaps your family or your wife or your husband, you just die if people knew that you'd done this. Perhaps even this week, let alone last year or 10 years ago. All those things that would so shame us, and in fact take us away from being glorious and being approved of and thought of as wonderful. All those things actually are gone. Jesus has paid for them. We will never be shamed because he has drunk in the cup of wrath, that Habakkuk. He has taken the shame, so we don't have to. That's the gospel that fuels this particular discipleship lesson. So he takes that. Why? Well, so that we can be set free to serve. They don't get it. And the rest of the disciples are annoyed that James and John have got in there first. Verse 41, when the 10 hear, they're indignant at James and John. And so he gives them the little discipleship lesson. And the lesson is about service and slavery. And Jesus is basically saying that greatness is found in being a servant or even a slave of all others. Of course, what he's doing, as I said at the beginning, is redefining greatness. Not greatness as in being approved of, but greatness as in doing a good job, a pleasing to God job of following Christ. Verse 42, you know that those who considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority, but it shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. Slave of all. It's said, apparently, the guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005, a guy called Mohammed Al-Baradei, and he's one of the there's a program on him on the radio this week because he's one of the potential people to bring some sort of calm to Egypt. He's Egyptian. When he won the Nobel Peace Prize and was seated up there on the stadium, the King of Norway presents the Nobel Peace Prize. He's Egyptian, speaks English, speaks Arabic, but the ceremony was being performed in English. He put on his headphones and flicked the dial to Norwegian, which he doesn't speak. His daughter let this on. He flicked the dial to Norwegian so that he wouldn't hear the speech being given about him, about what a great guy he was and what a great job he'd done of bringing peace. He didn't want to hear all the stuff about how great he was. And actually, that's what makes him great. I don't know anything about the guy's politics. He might be an expert on the Middle East. I'm not endorsing particularly any views he has. I just don't know. But in terms of leadership, that is great leadership. He'd done a good job, well enough to be recognised by the Nobel Prize. But he didn't want to hear about his glory. He was content with the job well done. And that's the kind of follower that Jesus wants. Serving, not to get glory, but for the sake of the service itself, for the sake of others. And so as we think about how to apply this, I suppose the obvious question, if you're a Christian, is, are you prepared to be a servant, or even, verse 44, a slave of all? Now, when Jesus teaches this, he doesn't teach it just in a kind of off, over the top, you go, you get on and be a servant or a slave. He leads. Verse 32, when he heads down to Jerusalem, going to die, to suffer, as they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed. Those details are there deliberately. Jesus leads, we follow. If you remember, Blackadder goes forth, that when they're all in the trenches. There's just a sort of memorable scene where it looks like finally they're going to have to go over the top. And General Melchett comes to visit the trenches and sort of grabs Baldrick, the little private, and says, don't worry, private. You know, if you should falter, myself and Captain Darling are right behind you. At which point Blackadder in the corner sort of makes an aside, yeah, about 35 miles behind us. It wasn't exactly inspiring leadership. Jesus is out ahead, being prepared to suffer, be humiliated, and as the Son of Man, the King of Glory, give himself for us. And so if we're not prepared to serve others, we're basically saying to Jesus, well, yeah, it's right for you to give up heaven to come and serve me, but not right for me to give up an hour's sleep to serve someone else. It's not right for me to give up my free time to go and help someone else. I am sufficiently great that I shouldn't be doing this slavery, this service. I outrank you, Jesus. And obviously, that is not the attitude of a Christian. Instead, wouldn't it be great if as a church or as families we had husbands who gave themselves up for their wives, were prepared to put their wives' needs above their own? A guy called Doug Wilson, who's an American writer, theologian, I think gives good advice in saying that don't think, husbands, that you'll be prepared to do the big thing, jumping in front of the bus to save your wife or your children, unless you've had a lifetime of being prepared to do the washing up for them, being prepared to tidy up after them, the little things. And it's in the little things, I think, that service for most of us is found. We may get to do the big heroic action over the top, throw ourselves in front of the bus and rescue, you know, the child from death. But for most of us, unlikely. And Wilson's point is probably right. Unless we've practiced, we'll never do it. But for most of us, it's the nitty-gritty details of life. The food gets passed round and we let, well, someone else have the biggest slice. It means that at work, when someone's junior to us and we have the power in our skills or in our position, but we're prepared to help the person further down the line, which never happens, does it? In the world, as Jesus says, as you go up the pyramid, you go further up and up and up in order to exert power, not in order to serve. If you remember at school in history, you used to do the feudal system, and you had the king at the top, and then you had a couple of barons, and then a few sort of gentry and bishops, and then right at the bottom was a mass load of peasants, millions of peasants, and it all built up this kind of apex with the king at the top. And the idea was the further down, the more serving you did. Jesus flips that whole pyramid upside down and says, look, I've served everybody giving my life. So my followers, in turn, should become servants of all. Servants of all. Not servants of your friends, just. Not servants of those who will appreciate it, just. Not servants when we'll be seen, but servants of all. So is it happening in our marriages? Is it happening in our church? Again, wouldn't it be great if we, let's say we're in charge of music and actually we plan songs that would please everybody else, or we turn up at church. Every fight in church, more or less, is about music, I've decided. So whilst we're new, I want to get it out of the way. Turning up, and rather than thinking, oh, I hate these songs, thinking, great, these are the songs that Phil really likes. And being pleased, because it's a way of serving them. Whole lives given for others. It means being proactive, not waiting till we're being asked. And not relying on rotas. My service is, well, I'm on the crash rotor. No, giving my life as an act of service, constantly. Actually, it's a noble aim as well for guys to aim to be servant leaders. Paul says, if you desire to be an elder, you desire to be a good thing. But again, desire to lead formally within church is a desire, should be a desire to serve. It's good, and if you're a guy, you should be thinking this way. Is this something, whether formally or just leading in some other way? But it is an aim always to be prepared to serve the slave, the lowest of the low. But before we finish, I just slightly want to expand this a bit too. There is, I think, the first way you read the Bible is, how do I live my life for Christ? What's he done for me and how do I live in response? It's like a personal way of reading the Bible. But it's not the only way to read the Bible. And I'm not even sure it's the main way to read the Bible. The story of the Bible isn't about Jesus coming and saving lots of individuals purely so he can sort of suck them off and whack them in heaven, and phew, they've escaped. The story of the Bible is a story of the whole universe, moving it from creation, through the fall, where it all goes wrong, to a renewed universe, a renewed world, a renewed society. And the call for the Christian is not just to sort myself out, so I'm all right, thanks, Jack, but actually to be an agent for change within the whole world. To bring, if you like, some of the heavenly kingdom forward. Bring heaven on earth, that's what we pray for. Your kingdom come. And so particularly here, in terms of this sort of cultural transformation, I suppose just a word on that. And there's a warning in verse 42. Jesus says actually that the rulers of the Gentiles will lord it over and exercise authority. Both those words are attacking words. In Acts 19, it's used of an evil spirit that jumps on someone and beats them up, has mastery over them. And Jesus is saying, look, your rulers at the time, it was the Romans and Herod, not great, they're going to be beating you around, grasping you, not serving. We see that pretty much down the centuries, more or less. Although we're told to submit to them and obey them and pray for them, more or less, rulers are grabbing of power. But actually, the way that's going to change, according to the Bible, is not by all the Christians picking up swords and attacking, or signing millions of petitions to complain, or whatever it might be. The way it changes is actually by the church being prepared to serve and give themselves as slaves for society as a whole. Just flip back with me to Daniel chapter 7. It's the last passage we're going to look at. Daniel chapter 7, it's on page 900. This is the great Son of Man passage. Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. Even the Son of Man came not to be served. Not to be served, but to serve. Yeah, it's right first time around. Look at that. Not to be served, but to serve. That's what he said in the passage in Mark. And Daniel 7 is the context for that. So, he has a dream. Verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, Daniel saw a dream. Daniel's a prophet. Verse 2, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came out of the sea, different ones, one from another. And he goes on to describe these four beasts, weird heads, all sorts of things, won't go into the details. He sees all the beasts, and then, verse 9, as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days, that's God, took his seat, so God's throne room appears. And we get a description of God. And then the scene changes again. We're still in the throne room, but verse 13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days. There's the Son of Man, Jesus, and was presented before God. And what happens? Well, to him, verse 14, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion and shall not pass away, and his kingdom, one that shall not be destroyed. Just be clear. So he sees four visions, then he sees God, and then he sees Jesus, the Son of Man, to whom all authority, all kingdoms are given, and then the angel explains what's going on. Verse 17, the angel says this, these four great beasts are four kings who shall rise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. The four kingdoms, the different empires that arose from between Daniel's time and Jesus, the last being the Romans. And the angel is saying, look, all these political rulers will rise up and oppress you. Okay, if we read the description of the beast, they are destroying the people, destroying the church. That will happen. That's what governors do, unfortunately. But what's going to happen is that Jesus will be given all authority, which is what happened at the resurrection. Remember the last words in Matthew? All authority in heaven and earth have been given to me. So at his resurrection, Jesus is made the true ruler. And from then on, the dominions, the tribes, the peoples and nations will be given to him. Slowly, the kingdom of this world will become the kingdoms of the Christ, as Isaiah tells us. And in fact, they're given not exactly to Jesus, but, verse 18, the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. Forever and ever. The pattern in the Bible is one of the increasing Christianization of the world, bit by bit, not in a steady sort of, always up. England has definitely had a dip, hasn't it? but of the world. These kingdoms will be given to Christ and therefore to his people. The reason I'm bringing that up here is that one of the things Jesus is getting at when he talks about the kingdoms and the Gentile rulers in Mark is that the way to see that process sped up, that Daniel process sped up, that the world become Christian, is not to go out and fight and destroy, but to serve, to give ourselves in our careers, give ourselves as a people in service to the world around. We don't conquer with the sword. It's not in the nature of our God, is it? God himself, as a Trinity, is giving. Father serves the Son, glorifies the Son. The Son, Jesus, glorifies the Spirit. The Spirit glorifies the Father. In the very nature of God, he's a giving God. He doesn't need to create people to give things to. He gives because of who he is. He's God. He's the Trinity. It's why the sort of sharper commentators have pointed out that Islam, that's just got one God with no persons in there, it's all about domination. Islam means submission. And so in Islamic sort of theology thinking, the way that you conquer is by beating people down, basically. It's spread by the sword. And everyone has to become servants. Allah, the thought of Allah serving anybody is outrageous. Or if you have no God at all, it's just survival of the fittest. It's dog eat dog, basically. Dawkins said this, from a Darwinian point of view, and a rational point of view, human niceness is just plain dumb. And he's right, isn't he? You know, if you want to be consistent with dog eat dog, well, I mean, you can occasionally be nice to people if it's going to get you a benefit, but there's no point serving people unless it's going to help you. It's just dumb. Just dumb, he's right. Thankfully, on the whole, I guess Dawkins and certainly many of his followers are mercifully dumb and are nice. But if you're consistent with an atheist worldview, you just attack, grab for yourself. But when you worship the Trinitarian God, one God in three persons who gives himself to one another and even gives up heaven to come and serve his people, to die for them, to be shamed for them, well, actually, it should motivate us to get off any little perches we've built and serve others. And that's why the story finished with Bartimaeus. The same question is asked to Bartimaeus that Jesus asked James and John, what can I do for you? And instead of saying, give me glory, what does Bartimaeus say? Son of David, have mercy on me. All he wants is mercy. If you're thinking, look, I just don't have the power to serve. I kind of know I should, but I don't want to. I don't like people enough. I don't have the love. I don't have the grace to do it. I don't have the picture of God. My boss is impossible to serve. My juniors are impossible to serve. My wife is impossible to serve. My children are impossible to serve. Son of David, have mercy on me. Bartimaeus starts the story sitting on the road, by the side of the road, begging. He ends up following Jesus on the way. Why? Because Jesus stops, even in the crowd, verse 49, stops and says, call him. Verse 52, Jesus says to him, go on your way. Your faith has made you well. Literally, your faith has saved you. Come to Jesus. He's come to serve you. And he's come to set you free. His life is a ransom for many. Set you free, and he set you free from sin, from focus on yourself, in order that you can serve, well, everybody. And let me pray, and then actually David's going to come and lead us. Oh Lord, we praise you that you are the God who serves and who doesn't take, who doesn't oppress, but gives himself, his very life for us. We pray that you might turn us, similarly, into those who are prepared to give our lives in service of all. Amen. David.